Please be advised that the following podcast contains vivid descriptions of sexual assault, which some listeners may find offensive. For the purpose of protecting the identity of the GBV survivor in this podcast, she will be referred to using an alias. The ongoing war on women's bodies is one of the greatest issues facing South African society. The quarterly crime stats released in June this year, which reflect crimes for the first 3 months of the year, showed a 13.7% increase over the same period last year in sexual offences. The unfortunate reality is these figures are likely to be much higher or don't reflect the true number of rapes, as many incidents go unreported. Here is Police Minister Becky Cele.
The first 3 months of this year, 10,818 people were raped in South Africa. Almost half of these cases, a staggering 4,653 rapes, took place at the home of the rape victim or the home of the rapist, mostly by a person known to the victim.
More than 80 undocumented suspects were arrested in Gauteng after the gang rapes of 8 women in Krugersdorp's West Village area last week. Despite these arrests and the police assuring South Africans the suspects will be brought to book, there is very little faith that this will happen, as victims of sexual assault have been failed by law enforcement and the legal system many times. Women are constantly living in fear of whether they will be the next to be attacked, the next statistic or headline. There are numerous cases that don't get the attention and outrage they deserve, and many will never make headlines on mainstream media. One such case is that of 52-year-old Margaret Mulawudzi from the village of Ngwanini Yamapoli in Toyandovenda. On March 6, 2022, Mulawudzi was raped by a man who entered her home in the early hours of the morning. Mulawudzi, a homeware saleswoman, lived alone in a two-bedroom house at the time.
Our trauma, no trauma,
they first broke into my house in 2020 on February 29th. And that first culprit is currently in jail. In 2022, on the 6th of March, there was another break-in. This time, he got in through the window. The intruder from 2020 broke in via the door, and the one from 2022 entered via the window, probably using a knife because the window was not broken. I heard him while he was already close to my bed. When I asked if it was a person, he quickly strangled me by my neck. This is the one from this year. He held me by the neck. I ended up saying, since you know what you are here to do, it's better you do what you are here to do and leave me alone. He battled with me. We scuffled. I prayed very hard. I prayed. I prayed to all the gods. I spoke to my ancestors. I spoke to God from heaven, asking, what am I being shown? Because this is happening to me again. He wanted a third round, but I told him since he said he was leaving in the morning, he should go and close the window where he had entered. When he left with his condoms. Instead of closing the window while he was inside, he closed it when he got on the outside. I thought he was coming back to continue doing what he was doing. I counted the time since he had left, then I stood up like someone who was cooperating and asked myself if he was coming back. When I looked, I realized he had entered through the window, but he had gone out and closed it. After this, I took my phone and fortunately there was network. I had some airtime as well. I called my mother and my colleagues. My colleagues advised me not to keep quiet, just to scream, so that people would see that there could be an intruder still in the house. After that, they advised me to go and report the case. After her assault, Mulawudzi was unable to immediately go to the police station or hospital because it was too late to walk in the dark. Later that morning, she visited the Donald Fraser Hospital Trauma Center. In the morning, I went to the hospital alone. I arrived and it was still early. They took their time to help me, but eventually they did help me. I was checked. I was given pills and I was given dates on when I needed to come back. One of those dates that I still have to go back for is on the 31st of August. I was checked by a doctor when I arrived. He did everything. They checked me and they bathed me. They also said they would take the information that they collected and they would give it to the police when they come. They placed everything that they had taken from my body into a police evidence bag. The police came to the hospital and they took my statement. But to this day, there has been no progress. I was given days to come back to see a counselor, but I missed the first date as at the time I was overwhelmed and I couldn't check anything. At that time, I realized that I had missed my first date to go and have a consultation. I called the hospital to schedule another date. Even now, I'm still consulting with my psychologist. I'm currently left with one other session or assessment that I have to do. Despite the victim receiving a full medical exam, the administering of a rape kit, and her statements taken by an investigating officer, police took more than a week to arrive at the crime scene. Those who were meant to come and collect evidence and take pictures took long. I reported my incident on the 6th of March, and they only came on the 16th of March. I had been calling them and asking them when my perpetrator was going to be arrested. They told me that it seemed as if my identification of this man was a rumor. I was advised by Michelle, a social worker, that it was within my right and the law that the police come and take DNA samples from the man. When the police finally came to collect the DNA, as well as take pictures of the evidence, they cut a piece of the curtain where my attacker's sperm had fallen and left with it. They also went to the window to take pictures, and the fingerprints of the boy were clear. According to me, they did the collection very well. They took pictures of everything. They also took my underwear, where it had been tossed after my attacker took it off me during our scuffle. Human rights and GBV activist Fiona Nicholson, who resides in Venda, was asked by a fellow activist to assist Mulawudzi with her case. After seeing how the case had been mishandled, Nicholson, who has been involved in GBV activism for more than 20 years, stepped in to help. Nicholson says the police only visited the crime scene after her intervention.
I was approached by a gentleman that I'd met on another project, on an environmental project, and he knew me by reputation. So he phoned me and he told me about what had happened. So I investigated. I said, okay, I'll check into it. And I was so appalled by what I learned that I had to get involved. One of the biggest challenges we have is that people actually don't have any expectations. They're so used to being badly treated by the police, and that they don't expect anything different. Now, When I started to get involved, I discovered that they'd never been to the scene of the crime. And it was only with my letters and my pushing that they eventually did, 10 days later, go and collect the evidence, the DNA evidence, semen stains, fingerprints from the window, and so on.
National Head of Family Violence, Child Protection and Sexual Offences, FCS, Major General Bafana Linda, explains the protocol that should have been followed.
The process is very clear in terms of management of such cases. That's the reason why we always have a member on standby. It's for that member to attend that matter within the period of 24 hours, because if General Linda is on standby this week, automatically then I'm available for 24 hours, and if the matter is at night, I could not go at night. In the following morning, I would have to go there and secure the crime scene and collect as much evidence as I can. It can't take 2 days for the police to come to the crime scene. They should come to the crime scene as soon as possible and to collect such evidence before the contamination of that evidence or the disappearance of evidence at the crime scene occurs.
Once the forensics evidence was collected at the crime scene, nothing was done. After months of runarounds and no communication or update from her investigating officer, Molawudzi says she received an SMS in June this year from the officer stating her case had been closed. Sometimes when I called them, their phone would go to voicemail and I would begin to think that they had blocked me. And when they would answer, they would politely tell me that they would come the following morning. However, they wouldn't. I then bought airtime so that I could ask them to explain what happened. When I spoke to my investigating officer, he told me the case had been closed, but he did not explain what that meant. He spoke in very few words. I didn't bother to ask any further. It was fine with me. In May, Nicholson was visited by police from another station about her first complaint on the mishandling of the case. She explains the critical issues she came across in the case, one of which was the checking of suspects' fingerprints against databases.
What the police actually said to me, because they came round to my home, I'd reported Toyando, so they couldn't investigate themselves, so that another police station sent their station commander to come and meet with me. And what he actually said to me was, Fiona, you've lived here a long time. You know how the scandal, if we go and interview the suspect, the people will talk in the village. Now, they have not even interviewed him, let alone taken fingerprints, let alone taken DNA. And how on earth do you prove anything without that? You know, what I would like to tell you is the two things that are really critical that are going on. The one is that that when the police do take fingerprints, they do not match them against a national database. They match them against their own database, which only contains the prints of known criminals or people who have been arrested before. So if it's a new criminal, they will never find him or her because they don't use for example, Home Affairs. They have a database with the fingerprints of everybody legally in South Africa, but they don't use that, even though more than 10 years ago, a bill was passed instructing the police to use every database in the country. They still don't to this day. So frankly, how do they expect to catch criminals? How can they, if somebody keeps raping and they get away with it and they're never fingerprinted, how will they ever be caught? How will they ever be stopped?
Major General Linda explains how suspects' fingerprints are processed once they have been collected, saying they are only checked against their criminal record center.
Once those fingerprints has been are positive, they get deposited in our database within the criminal record center, whereby then they get checked whether such a person has been dealt with before, or is it the first person. So it gives us a lead. It gives us a lead, then we are able to have this forensic lead followed and be able to apprehend a suspect. If it's a first offender, there is no other fingerprints of the person that can be found there in comparison, then that will be remain deposited for future references. We don't check that with Home Affairs. We only check that with our Criminal Record Center. And when you look at the issue of the fingerprints found at the crime scene, sometimes you find fingerprints there that they are not enough for comparison when they check it, and it does not become positive. And if it becomes positive, then the further internal systems are being utilized. I think you might be aware that it's work in progress, whereby the criminal system will be linked together. And I do want to mention as well that not everybody's fingerprint is on the Home Affairs system. As you know, that we also do have undocumented persons within the country itself.
Speaking to Times Live, an emotional Mulawudzi broke down as she relayed having to see her perpetrator in the same community every day. She adds that crime in her community is rampant, especially the crimes of rape and housebreaking. She adds that police take their time to do their jobs. I see the perpetrator every day. He is a young man. He was probably born in the early 2000s. He is probably 22 or in his early 20s this year. This is someone that I used to meet around my neighborhood. I didn't know at the time that he was a criminal or that one day he would rape me. I can run into him while on my way to somewhere, and when I come back, I run into him again. When I'm going to my mother's house, I sometimes see him walking behind me. This is one of the things that pains me the most. In my village, the crime is rampant. There is rape, there are house breakings. Just recently, a man was attacked and he's still in hospital. However, nothing has been done yet. The police are relaxed. They do not do anything. Mulawudzi has since left her home where the incident took place and is now living with her mother. When asked how she gets up each day and keeps going, she says she is grateful for her family, friends, community, and those who have advocated for her, such as social worker Michelle Munyai, who has helped her fight her case alongside Nicholson. The people who have been supporting me have been my parents, Fiona, Michelle, my colleagues, as well as the headman in the village. They have influenced me not to give up. They have influenced me to keep praying to God. When I am reminded of the incident and I have to relive it, the pain comes back. Munyai says she feels sad and angry that nothing has been done about the case, despite police having the necessary resources at their disposal.
I spoke with her. I felt the need to give her support as I was not able to work on her case since she stays far from where I stay. But I felt the need as a citizen and also as a social worker and as an activist as well. I felt the need to want to know why the police are taking so long to want to help a person who has endured so much pain. It still makes me very sad and angry that nothing has been done yet, and yet she has not found closure to what has happened to her. Every day she sees a perpetrator. It's very, very stressful as a human being too, not as an activist or social worker. But just seeing that a lot of people are even afraid to go and report a case knowing that nothing is going to happen, it's quite shocking. This whole situation was more like a mirror to me to say what is happening to women in South Africa. It's happening every day, yet people are scared to talk about it because they know that the same police are going to say there's no evidence while the evidence is in their faces. Well, they have the resources and the capacity to go and do something about their job.
Mulawuzi says she would like the government to recognize and respect women so they can feel protected. Women must be respected and be counted as people because they say they respect women, but it is only verbally that they say this. Women must be respected as well as heard. My message to all the women in South Africa is that we must not keep quiet. We must stand up and we must endure until the government listens to us. A 2020 article published by online nonprofit fact checker Africa Check states that many rape victims do not report the crime due to stigma, a lack of support from their communities, and distrust in the police. In this case, we have seen that despite reporting her case, the victim has seen no justice, and unfortunately, it is one of many sexual assault cases that fall through the cracks. SA faces an epidemic of sexual violence and rape perpetuated against women, and if we are to win the fight against gender-based violence in South Africa, there needs to be significant intervention from all spheres of society, especially within law enforcement. For Times Live Podcasts, I'm Demi Buzo.